Welcome to Masters of the Stage. This SDC Foundation program illuminates the creative processes, secret mottos, and personal and professional experiences that guide today's luminary directors and choreographers as they forge artistic careers in a profession that has no handbook. These intimate and dynamic conversations between today's most successful artists offer audiences rare insights into the challenging and ever-changing world of theater making.
Hi, I'm M. Graham Smith, and this is Masters of the Stage, Regional Originals brought to you by the SDC Foundation. Our guest today is Blanca Ziska. Blanca is an American theater director and playwright. She is currently the founding artistic director of the Wilma Theater. Ziska defected from Czechoslovakia in 1976 with her partner Jiří Ziska and came to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They joined up with a theater collective called the Wilma Project. Then, in 1981, she and Jiří became co-artistic directors of the Wilma Theater, known for their bold productions of the works of Bertolt Brecht, Eugene Ionesco, and Tom Stoppard. She has directed over 70 plays and musicals at the Wilma. In 2011, Blanca received the Zelda Fitchhandler Award from the Stage Directors and Choreographers Foundation, which recognizes an outstanding director or choreographer transforming the regional arts landscape. In January 2016, the Vilcek Foundation announced Ziska as recipient of the Vilcek Prize, which is awarded annually to immigrants who have made a lasting contribution to American society through their extraordinary achievements. And as of early 2018, she has won 14 Barrymore Awards, which recognizes excellence for professional theater in the greater Philadelphia area. Thank you so much for sitting down with me today, Blanca. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
The first question I'd like to ask you, just to situate our listeners, is where did you grow up and how did you find theater?
So as you said, I grew up in Czechoslovakia. And Czechoslovakia was a country that doesn't exist any longer now. It's the Czech Republic and Slovakia, split in 1992. But at the time when I was growing up there, it was a communist country, but I was 14 in 1968 when the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact army invaded Czechoslovakia because there was this kind of humanistic revolution, as they called it, socialism with human face. And that revolution was suppressed, and the aftermath was pretty grim. Which means that, lots of people went to jail, lost jobs, kids could not study because of their parents' involvement with the previous government. And that's one of my cases. You know, I could not go to university. I had no way to study anything. So I got involved in an underground theater scene, and kind of education really was going on the weekends to Poland, and there I saw Tadeusz Kantor work and Grotowski work, and I went to festivals there where I saw also Living Theater and Schumann's Bread and Puppet Theater, you know, and many other companies that you would not be able to see in Czechoslovakia. And you think of, you know, at the time, at least the Westerners thought of the countries behind the curtain, behind the Iron Curtain, as being the same. But the difference, you know, between Poland at the time and what was happening in Czechoslovakia were tremendous differences. And so that's going to be, we went to Poland to breathe freedom. But I had no really idea at that point that I was being exposed to this amazing avant-garde, you know, and a theater that was very brave and, you know, visceral and physical and ritualistic and kind of a whole new direction that was happening in the 70s. And of course I thought at that point, oh God, I have to go to the United States, find a way to like work with Bread and Puppet or Living Theater. But by the time I got here, it was actually later. I got here I left Czechoslovakia in 77. And, you know, by the time I kind of started to look into the theater and all that, you know, Reagan came, and all these companies that were so vibrant in the mid of 70s were gone, basically. Yeah. So my theater education was through this kind of underground activity and through puppet theater, because Czechoslovakia was really rich in puppet theater, and I used to go to see it all, you know, since age of 3 or 4, every Sunday, like going to church.
That's fantastic. Yeah. It's it strikes me as maybe unusual that someone who comes from this passion for very avant-garde, experimental Eastern European theater and puppet theater is now running one of the most important and largest theater institutions in Philadelphia. How did you take all of that education and that passion and that sense of that aesthetic and bring it to your work running this major regional theater in Philadelphia?
So, the road to running a major regional theater was long and painful many times. You know, we started on, the first production was done on $600 budget, which was including advertising, you know, and there was Animal Farm by George Orwell. We adapted it, Yuri and I, and without knowing that we actually should be writing, you know, paying for rights or getting the rights, we just did it completely, like, you know, there. Did it in the found a space, you know, played for 50 people, basically. But it was like the beginning, you know, and I just learned everything about it by doing it, you know. I had no idea that, it, like, you need to have a non-profit and you need to have a board of directors and all that stuff, so that you need to write press releases, you know, that you need to, the funding situation, I didn't know anything about. So at that time, you know, I had from Czechoslovakia this idea that to do a theater is privilege, right? That you actually, that you can find your time, you know, amateur, you know, like a celebrated amateur, you know, you find your time, you do it whenever you can, then you put it on, and it's amazing that people come.
Yes.
You know, and so that was kind of my attitude at the very beginning, but of course, you know, that changes over years, because then it becomes 80-hour-long big job, right? And
yeah,
and you know, you cannot sustain it as a volunteer.
No.
Right? So so we started to as we moved into full-time positions and, you know, paid ourselves $10,000 a year and $12,000 a year and so on, you know, we are growing, the productions were becoming bigger and all that. And I have to say that I feel also that even though we were, in terms of content that we were picking up, it was always plays that were somehow dealing with today's reality, or we're commenting on today's reality, or we're, you know, exploring the themes and questions that are being asked in the time. And but we're kind of translating into artistic gesture. So we were never doing completely like a documentary theater or totally naturalistic theater. It was always kind of a sense of metaphor, and I think it also is probably something that what we learned to do in Czechoslovakia, because you could not say anything directly, right? So you had to find a way of going around, and so metaphor was a way of expressing everything. So it was kind of something that stayed with us, and we are exploring it even here. But I have to say that after years that I also, I could not sustain it, and I kind of fell into that machine which the regional theater kind of turned out to be. That idea that, you know, the subscribers are the people who pay for everything, and therefore you have to get as many subscribers as possible. And then everything has to kind of fit the subscriber schedule, the calendar, right? So you create this calendar, and even if you are doing a huge project that could be for 25 people, you still do it in 4 weeks,
right?
You know, and it's so many performances, and then you do a, you know, play for two characters, and it's the same schedule. So kind of craziness, really. And so we kind of fell into that pattern, which, you know, after going, you know, later on into the New Wilma and all that, I got to the point when I felt actually it's not sustainable for me as an artist, and either I will stop doing theater altogether or I change completely the way I work at the Wilma. And so I did change about the work, the way we are working.
What did you change? How does it work now?
So I have got very tired from just that idea of constantly casting new people and starting always from scratch. You know, and when you are casting people, you go to New York a lot of the time, and you have two managers already sitting between you and the artist, the other artist. You have casting director and you have agent, right? And you are not talking to each other. We don't know each other, and there are already so many barriers put up by these two managers. You know that it's almost impossible. You almost hate the people by the time,
right.
Because of all the negotiations and all that. By the time, you know, it becomes about job. It doesn't become about calling. And theater needs to be calling in my mind. And then the actors come in, you know, and the first thing that you are experiencing being in the room is fear,
yeah,
and distrust and egos. Fear and egos come always hand in hand,
yep,
right? Yeah, hello, here we are, and you cannot do anything.
Right.
You ask for something, an actor will tell you, oh, let me think about it. I will go home and think about it, and I'll show you the next day, because they don't have the courage to actually fail in front of you. You know, so I have come to a conclusion that to start always from scratch and dealing with this situation every time I start a rehearsal is really loss of time. And you also sometimes end up, you know, working with people that you don't know, and you would never choose to work with them if you would know them.
Right.
You know, you just kind of end up in a room bearing yourself, trying to create something, you know, yes. And you realize you are not with the right people.
Yeah.
So I wanted to avoid it. I just had enough of it. And so I decided that the only way I can keep on doing it, if I create some kind of a sense of continuity and methodology that will bring us all together. So I've started the company. First, it started with just doing workshops for local actors. Really, I was going to now invest all my energy into Philadelphia actors. And so I started to bring people that I kind of knew about. It's kind of these master directors, teachers, who had long experiences, lifetime experiences, of having a company and developing methodologies for their companies. And I thought I was trying to kind of cut short a little bit, you know, like having creating a bridge
yep.
for myself, because we didn't have that chance doing it for so many years. So I wanted to learn from these people. And so we started to bring these directors, master teachers to Philadelphia and create this like long 2-week, 3-week workshops. And I did a lot of fundraising, and I was able to pay actors to take these workshops.
Fantastic.
And that was the beginning of it. And out of that then grew this idea of creating a company, which we are calling Hut House.
Yes.
Wilma Hut House Company. And we meet every Monday, which you can see, like, we are really dedicated, because some of the Hut House members are now at the Wilma production. They work from Tuesdays through Sunday, and then on Monday, day off, they come. Other actors are working in some of the theaters around the city,
sure.
And yet they come because this idea of having a company and being there for each other and exploring new material or new methodologies together and exploring what is hidden inside of your body and how to release those energies, how to find the material that is hiding in your body, how to be open, and is something that has become like a, you know, essential, like bread, you know, for us. We need it almost. It's kind of a... Yeah, and it's all about work. It's not some like Kool-Aid, you know, drinking Kool-Aid.
Right, right.
It really is about physical and intellectual work.
And it's a 5-hour session?
5-hour long session, yeah.
Every Monday.
Every Monday.
And how many actors are in the Hut House
15.
Now? 15.
Yeah.
And that forms the core
yeah.
of the actors that you
yeah.
work with.
Yeah, and one
here.
Of the also really important part of the company is it's a racially mixed company, which causes some problems, you know, simply because it's difficult to find work, new work, you know, that is written for a composition that we have in the company, because so many new works are written out of identity.
Yes.
Right. And we are actually kind of looking at this problem by now commissioning writers to write directly for the company.
That's fantastic. And how long has the hothouse been happening?
4 years now.
Four.
Yeah. But a lot of these actors have been part of these ongoing workshops. So I would say like a lot of them have been involved in this kind of intense work for about 7 years.
That's great. I want to ask you a little bit about new plays, because the Wilma is known for new contemporary work, and how fascinating that you're mm-hmm. talking about now commissioning writers to write for the hothouse actors and the core company that you have. And I think about the fact that when we're working with dead playwrights, you know, we have a lot of permission to do many, many things that maybe the playwright never intended for the work. But with new writers, can you tell us a little bit about the way that you like to work with a writer, how your development process works when you start approaching a new play?
So I was just working with Christopher Chen on Passage. And it was kind of a great piece for us, because Passage is for about 10 actors or 11 actors. But Christopher doesn't designate the roles by gender or by race. And so every director who's going to be directing this play can cast it the way they see it fit, you know. So we thought originally there would be actually Justin Jane, member of the company, was the one who brought the play to the company. And we got very excited about it. But I brought Christopher here for a workshop, and we were working on the play, everybody was working on everything. All the actors were working on each of the characters, because we didn't know how you were going to cast it. And the thing that I do with, and Christopher really loved this, that I am looking as writing or language as physical force, you know. And so I look at language as a last layer of the process, you know. So let's say, you know, in our body we have emotions, you know. Out of the emotion comes a sound. Out of the sound, a word is created. After a word, you construct a sentence or phrase, and then sentence, right? So we are kind of working now backwards, right? We are looking at, we have now sentences, complicated sentences, and now we are looking back to what was that initial emotion that is filling the sentences, right? So I am working a lot with sound and really sounding the words, and slowly, you know, memory. Memory. And through this kind of exercise, you are starting to actually discover, strangely, emotions.
Yep.
It's starting to fill you with something. And Christopher Chen was just beside himself with happiness when he said that. He said, I have never experienced anything like this. And this is not something that I came up with. It actually is very much kind of formed by ideas of Cecily Berry,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
who was working for a long time with Peter Brook and was also with the
Royal
Shakespeare Company. Yeah, you know, so it is about how language lives inside of your body. It's not in your brain; it's inside of your body, right?
Yeah.
So. And then we do other things, like once you kind of find, those Cecily Berry exercises, you know, they're kind of like walking through the room and with every punctuation making sharp turn, you know, getting the structure of the sentences in your body. And once you have it, what we do also is that we work on the text, that an actor, we have a ghost actor who's reading the text, and then character actor who's playing the character, right? And he's phrasing, you know, the sentences according again, you know, by punctuation. and then an actor who is standing in front of this ghost. So the ghost is whispering these phrases into his back, and an actor doesn't know where it's going to go even. You know, so he doesn't know if the sentence is short, if it's a sentence is long. So which means that an actor has to be in the state of readiness, complete readiness, because you don't know where you are going to go. And it's amazing, because suddenly in that state of readiness, your body is present. And that means your memory of your body is present too. And without doing any analyses, actors go to the core of the character. It's just kind of mind-boggling, you know. I'm always, always so surprised how quickly, you know, they go to it. And it's there is no psychology, Lee Strasberg imagination.
Yeah.
If, you know, none of that. And instincts, or I think that, you know, we kind of like work with this idea that body knows the score, body knows. But you have to open the channels to understand what the body knows, you know, because we create our way of living and surviving, you know, and our body is not active any longer. We don't rely on our body to give us information, because the information is on the internet, right?
Yes, yes.
So, so it's kind of like the work that we are doing in the Hot House is to rekindle this connection, these connectors to the body information.
That's fantastic. So we've talked a little bit about how you work with writers and how you work with actors. Could you say a little bit about how you bring your work on a new play forward with designers, and how are designers part of your new play development process? I notice that the set for Kill Move Paradise by James Imes, which is in the Wilma right now, although by the time this airs it will be closed, is a very stunning piece of scenic design that is this huge abstract space that's all kind of blank and intriguing. How did that come about?
I think that's kind of also the Wilma aesthetic, you know, because I'm just so focusing on actor's body in our performance. I'm giving them a space. Right, so the active body needs to be in an open space. So, you know, I have 5 props in this show.
Yeah.
And out of those 5 props, there are 2 like balls of wrinkled paper, right?
Uh-huh.
So, that is, you know, the stage for a passage by Christopher Chen too. It was very open space, you know, and. I have been working with Matt Saunders, who is a terrific designer, also works nationally, really well known, but he's here from Philadelphia. I've been working with him for years, so we have a kind of a shortcut, you know, we just understand each other really well. And with this design, usually I'm like very involved in, because the world of the play is very important to me, because that is the world.
Yeah.
You know, that is the world that the actors have to learn to live in this world. So in this Kill Move Paradise, you have this really 14 feet high kind of moving floor that it goes up, you know, that changes almost into a wall, right?
Yeah.
And the actors have to learn to walk on it, because that's their world, you know. So it's very important that the set becomes kind of character and is helping the actors to create a story. So in this case, the set creates also for the actors an obstacle, which is something that needs to happen in this play, and also creates a total physical and emotional exhaustion, because they cannot master it, right? They are trying. And so what happens in the play is that the actor's emotional and physical exhaustion mirrors the exhaustion, physical and emotional, of the characters. Yeah.
How, I mean, if we were like eavesdropping on the first conversation that you would have with a designer like Matt, someone that you work with a lot, what would you talk about in that first meeting? Would you be looking for the scenic designer to bring you some images? Would you be giving the scenic designer instructions? I need a space that's open and empty. and that can support a lot of movement?
A lot of the times I just like write notes in which I just kind of my intuitions about it. And it could be totally stupid. I'm not afraid of saying things that are out there or crazy or not possible to actually achieve. But it gives them kind of a sense about how I think, and then they are starting to find a way of connecting and bridging it and translating it into what they need. I am a very visual director, so I do get very involved with, you know, both lights and set. Because for me, I think of myself sometimes more like a conductor, choreographer than a director. You know, Pina Bausch is somebody that I feel very connected to because, you know, her. I also work a lot, you know, that many times the emotional intensity is expressed through choreography, you know, that the actors, depending, you know, like the emotions or intensity is also on the distance, you know, kind of how far they are away from each other or, you know, all that, you know, it's a constant choreography on stage, which again is not, you know, like naturalism, you know, it's more of a expressionistic, I think, rendering of whatever is inside of the actors to kind of bring it into space.
That's fantastic. It reminds me of where we started the conversation in terms of this very experimental, expressionistic, metaphorical presentation of plays that address social justice issues, plays mm-hmm. that address political issues.
Yes, Kiln of Paradise, you know, for instance, is a play that James wrote in a kind of response to an ongoing killing of black men and women by the police, you know, and that killing is connected to, you know, lynching beforehand and slavery beforehand, you know. So it's the violence against black men and women and children. And yet, you know, he displaces the story that we hear or see in the newspapers or on television and puts it into this space, which is kind of this waiting station, this cosmic limbo, right?
Yes.
And so it becomes a different story. It becomes this kind of a very touching, impossible story of dead people wanting to live.
Yeah.
And so the play is about dead people, but it's vibrant with life.
Yeah.
You know? And there is humor, there is absurdity. There are emotions, of course, and there is a moment of total reality when the list of people killed in the last 20 years is being read, and we have already added three names just between rehearsals and a beginning of the run.
Just in 4 weeks.
In 4 weeks, yeah. And so the list keeps on growing, and I have to say that actually rehearsing that list was the most difficult thing in the whole rehearsal process. And you will see, the rehearsal process was not easy because you will be seeing people falling and rolling around in that set and falling, you know, in like in drastic ways.
Yeah.
But actually going through the list and reading the list was impossible because you are suddenly dealing with real people,
yeah.
real lives and real deaths. And to rehearse that is kind of almost impossible.
Yeah. If we could switch gears just for a moment, I saw the production of Octoroon here
mm-hmm.
2 years ago, and I haven't stopped talking about it since then. And I know you didn't direct that production, but one of the extraordinary things about watching that production was looking around the audience in the theater and noticing that I think from any regional theater I've ever attended in my life, your audience is by far the most diverse and also the youngest. And I realize this is because you have an incredible program where anyone who's a student or anyone who self-identifies as an artist can purchase a ticket for $10
mm-hmm.
to any show. There's no like restricted dates or, you know, you have to do it, you know, by this far in advance.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that program and how that's transformed the audience in the theater?
This started about 4 years ago. Unfortunately, we are not kind of getting the funding to probably in the future to keep on doing this. But it was the WinCode Foundation program. We called it WinTix. And we were able to offer tickets to everybody for $25. And $10 for students and artists. It has, you know, it has been for me, I was really excited about doing it. But for my board of directors, was actually, it's a very questionable program. Mm. And, you know, we have obviously different opinions about this. You know, I've on the board, successful business people, and
right, you know, right, right.
And we have very different opinions about how tickets should be sold. But because we have not brought more people in, right, based on this tickets, and but you know, we don't know how many more people we would have lost,
sure,
because we are. Everybody in the regional theater is now in a situation where the subscription model is gone, basically, and it's not that easy to get single ticket buying on repeatedly, right?
Yeah.
People have now so many different choices.
Yes.
You know, how you spend the time and how to entertain yourself, that it's actually finding the time and making a decision to go to theater is an act of will, basically.
Yeah.
So it's not easy, right? But yes, I think our audience did become younger and also racially much more mixed, especially if we do writers, you know, that are writers of color. We can start seeing that, you know, but it's still slow, you know, I think. I mean, my biggest question is really talking about, you know, audiences. It's like, you know, do people want to actually go to theater, and is it, you know, does theater
matter
as an institution like this? Does it have future? You know, I think theater matters and will have future, but maybe in different forms that we know.
Part of this program is about going out into the regions away from New York,
mm-hmm,
and thinking about the American regional landscape. Could you tell us just a little bit about what you feel characterizes Philadelphia as a region? What can people expect from a Philadelphia play, from a play that they would see in this town? What are Philadelphia audiences like? What's your region like?
So I feel Philadelphia, like about 15 years ago, experienced a profound change. And there was time when the Philadelphia, the Pew Foundation, and Independence Foundation still is doing it, and William Penn Foundation were regularly investing into the arts here in Philadelphia, and also into individual artists. So it was actually possible for young artists to come here and start to create projects or start a company, you know. So we have a lot of young companies around here. And I think also partially because of Pig Iron Theater and the New Paradise Theater and Headlong also, we have a lot this kind of a actor / director / author situations. So a lot of original work being created. It's very exciting, some really very exciting work.
And all of those groups that you just mentioned also have a very physical dimension to what
right.
they do, yes?
Yes, that's what I'm talking about. There's kind of a focus on physical theater in Philadelphia, I would say, in a big way. But also on kind of, you know, as a lot of young artists are doing anyway, crossing the boundaries, you know, so dance, visual arts, music, all coming together, you know, in one performance. Which, you know, to me, that is something what I feel the totality of theater is. You know, it always has been like
yes.
this. You know, it's like only like the end of the 19th century when he started to create this fourth wall and
yes.
psychological theater, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So I feel like what is not happening yet in Philly is that what is happening is that there is a great support of artists from other artists. People are really, you know, collaborating, supporting each other. We are supporting young companies or young artists. That all is great. But we are all kind of living in a bubble, in this artistic bubble. And I feel like we don't know yet, or we don't have the means or the methodology yet, or to find how to burst it and how to get people from outside of that bubble to come and see the work.
Yeah.
And that's a big problem, you know, because the bubble is still small, you know, and we need actually our public to understand. On the other hand, I think Philadelphia has this and always had this kind of a shyness of being in the shadow of New York, right? We still have people here who say, oh, for theater, I have to go to New York, which is crazy because there is so much good stuff here in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And that we don't have also, I think, I wish like our writers who write about theater should be a little bit more responsive and proud of what's happening here in Philadelphia. You know, like the Wilma has a great national reputation, but you'll be surprised how we are dealt with here in Philly, right?
Do you have a full-time reviewer at any of the papers here anymore?
No.
Wow. That's a problem too, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that also, it's, you know, there's a lot of dedicating writers, but I also am finding with the work that I'm doing, and I think Pig Iron or New Paradise, you know, we are finding it difficult because a lot of the writers that write about theater think of theater as literature, as a piece of literature only. There is a great paper or a website, Thinking Dance, and they are now expanding into covering theater, and that really excites me because the writers that are writing for Thinking Dance are really interested in the performance aspect of any production, and I think we don't have enough of that.
Maybe that will be more what we can look forward to in the future, as I'm sure a lot of regions are losing their critics, their full-time critics for theater. We just have a few more minutes left, and I wonder if you have any advice that you might offer young emerging directors who, you know, maybe they're in a similar place to where you were when you arrived in Philadelphia, and you're thinking, what can I do? What is the career path for me, or what is the best way that I can develop the curiosity and passion that I have?
Well, the curiosity is number one. You know, like you have to kind of constantly keep on learning and listening. Being curious is the number one, I think. I think that you really need to be passionate about the work that you are doing. Otherwise, it's not worth the time, the energy, the pain, and all that that comes with it. You really have to think, you have to really believe that this is the only thing that you can do. I think the other is, in spite of some of the difficulties that come with it and egos that come, keep generosity, you know, around you. Be generous. Learn from other people. Listen. I think one of the things that I am finding out is that the art of listening, without it, actually creativity doesn't exist, you know. And we are now at the time when everybody preaches. Everybody has an opinion, and we are all preaching. And I think the listening and learning from listening and creating from listening is something that we need to kind of refocus on. Otherwise, you know, find also like people that you think they represent in your eyes what you would like to do, or whom you would like to learn, and find a way to work with them or see their work. I think one can learn a lot, you know, about yourself when you actually watch other people working, because you can then ask yourself about your own ways of approaching material and how it differs and why, and analyze all that, you know, when you agree or when you don't agree. I would do that. I'm still like, I'm totally a student. I can be a student, you know. When I went for the first time to visit this Theodoros Terzapolos in Greece, I took a workshop with the 25-year-olds in his method. You know, I spent 3 weeks sweating there with the 25-year-olds.
Yes.
You know, and I think that's kind of, that's probably what I would say, keep on doing.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Earlier in the conversation, this will be my last question, you said, you know, maybe the American theater is not necessarily going to look like what it currently looks like now in terms of the way that the regions have their institutions, and that there's a very, as we were saying at the beginning of the conversation, like a conveyor belt almost, like a machine of how all shows have to get built. What, you know, if you know, what would you imagine the future might look like 30 years from now, given the trends that you are in a very good position to observe as the leader of this institution? Where do you think the American theater might be going?
I don't know. I think it's going to be project-based situation, but mainly because there will not be financial support for sustaining organizations like who have, you know, this kind of art centers. And because I also feel that we have created, you know, these bureaucracies around theaters, and these bureaucracies exist only to support the work on stage. So I don't know, it has turned around, you know, not so much now, but, you know, 20 years ago it was like the art was supposed to support the bureaucracies, which
right,
is crazy,
right,
you know, to keep those jobs for people in development and marketing and all that, instead of actually finding a way of supporting the artists on stage and the work on stage. You know, and that needs to fall apart, that needs to go. So maybe there is kind of reimagining how we can, you know, how we can create projects. I don't want to lose this kind of idea of that there is also skill and craft that needs to be practiced, and that actually the practice itself is giving you joy of living.
Yes.
And we are kind of cutting that down more and more because of the finances, right?
Yes.
So, but I feel that I want to fight for, you know, because I feel like actors need to be practicing.
Yes.
You know, they cannot be just sitting at home and waiting.
Right.
Right.
To create a product.
In a way, I feel like what's happening here in Philadelphia with these younger artists is what I experienced in Czechoslovakia. Nobody has money and everybody's creating. You know?
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
It's kind of that kind of revolution.
It's a lot of joy.
It's like, it's now like, but now, you know, the next thing is how to actually get the audiences, which, you know, which is when you have Netflix and, you know, like really good television and all that stuff.
Right.
It's really difficult.
Yeah. Are there any things coming up that our listeners can see that you're directing in the end of 2018 or 2019?
Well, we have been talking about new plays, and I will say, okay, and I'm going to be directing Romeo and Juliet with Hot House. But I am kind of doing it, you know, with a rock and roll band, and, you know,
yes.
And I have 10 students from University of the Arts who are going to play character of youth, you know, it's kind of a chorus.
Yes.
I don't know yet what it's going to be, but so that's a piece that I'll be working on in January. Then we are bringing Dominic Saran to direct Kate Tarker's play, which is a new play. Dionysus was a nice man that she wrote directly for the Hot House. So that's going to be happening in the spring. And then I'm going to be working on a poem by Etel Adnan, who is a Lebanese writer who lives now in Paris, but she spent 30 years living in San Francisco. And she writes in English, and she wrote this amazing poem there, which is about the lightness and darkness of the other. And it's very much about our time. She wrote it as kind of a reaction to the war in Yugoslavia in 1990s, but it's a big poem about all different kinds of time, but I don't know what I'm going to be doing with it at all yet. I just know that I'll be doing it.
And that will also be in the spring or the
that
summer?
That will be in September.
September, yeah. Of 2019. Great. Well, Blanca, thank you so much for sitting down today and having this conversation. This was incredible.
Okay, thank you so much.
This podcast was brought to you by SDC Foundation. SDC Foundation events and programs are designed to offer access, opportunity, and community to directors and choreographers at all levels of their career. To find out more, visit our website at www.sdcfoundation.org.